Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show, pomp and protest, Donald Trump's state visit to the UK. Turning tide, as the EU Commission calls for a freeze on free trade with Israel, we look at two countries, Spain and the Netherlands, keeping the Palestinian cause in the spotlight. And Swedish spy church, a story you have to hear to believe.
It is definitely a tool for Russian foreign influence. And it's a tool that could be used in soft power ways, but also into intelligence or even sabotage.
Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Let's begin the show with a quick flashback.
Can I present a letter from the King to you?
Thank you very much. Perhaps you'd like to say what that very important paragraph...
Yes, so this is a letter from His Majesty the King...
It's February 2025, and it's the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer's turn to pay his respects to the freshly inaugurated President Donald Trump in the White House. Keir Starmer comes armed with a letter, a very special letter, as he is at pains to point out, an invitation from the King, no less, for an unprecedented second state visit. Well, this week, the UK came good on that promise, as did King Charles and his family, perhaps even more so than expected, since with London out of bounds due to protest fears, it fell to the royal residence at Windsor Castle to play host. So, how did the visit go from a British perspective? Well, as of Thursday morning when we went to studio, the answer seemed to be surprisingly smoothly. Here's Stuart Smith's report.
It's been 2 days of pomp and protest. The day the US president landed in London, a large photo of himself and American paedophile Jeffrey Epstein was unfurled on the lawn of Windsor Castle. On Wednesday, demonstrators outside the British Parliament described Donald Trump as fascist and claimed Keir Starmer was weak for indulging the president rather than standing up to his alleged bullying. Seamus Yeda from the Stop Trump Coalition said inviting Trump for a second state visit was sycophantic.
We're out here protesting because we are disgusted and humiliated that our Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has invited Donald Trump here for a second unprecedented state visit that just wasn't necessary.
A poll earlier this month found nearly two-thirds of Brits don't like Donald Trump, and just under a third thought the state visit shouldn't have even gone ahead. But many against Trump's politics still see the value of the visit. Here's the first Welsh minister, Elynydd Morgan.
We have about 250 companies based in Wales, providing thousands of jobs, and we have lots of offices in the United States trying to promote and bring people here and investment here. And you know, I think it is important for us to maintain that relationship.
Prime Minister Keir Starmer will be hoping that such strategic concerns will endure long after the protesters have gone home. Donald Trump seemed to be impressed. At the state banquet on Wednesday, he told an assortment of royalty, politicians, celebrities and business leaders that it was one of the highest honours of his life.
We're joined by history and fate, by love and language, and by transcendent ties of culture, tradition, ancestry and destiny.
But while the visit has so far gone off without a hitch, it's been a politically challenging month for Keir Starmer. At the weekend, an estimated 150,000 people attended what was at times a violent nationalist rally in Westminster, led by the far-right activist Stephen Yaxley-Lennon, aka Tommy Robinson. Joining by video was the world's richest man, Elon Musk, who called for a change of government in London and on British people to rise up.
Whether you choose violence or not, violence is coming to you. You either fight back or you die. You either fight back or you die.
Meanwhile, Keir Starmer has three times in the last 2 weeks had to defend his administration from allegations it was falling apart after he was forced to sack his deputy prime minister, his top aide, and the UK ambassador to Washington right before the state visit. The latter, ex-ambassador Peter Mandelson, considered the architect of Tony Blair's New Labour project, was fired over close links to convicted sex offender and child trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, a relationship Donald Trump also finds himself trying to keep out of the spotlight. Unsuccessfully, as this action by the British campaign group led by Donkeys demonstrated when they projected images of Trump, Epstein and Britain's Prince Andrew onto the walls of Windsor Castle. Instead, it will be the deals the two leaders have agreed that Keir Starmer will want to highlight. A new US-UK tech partnership, which London claims will plough tens of billions of dollars of investment into Britain from America's top technology firms, on top of new investments in civilian nuclear power and British pharmaceuticals. The Prime Minister has repeatedly said wealth creation is his number one priority, and huge investments like that in frontier technology that London believes will define the rest of the 21st century will help him sell to a sceptical electorate that he is making headway with an economy that so far refuses to grow. But the pressure is on. The Reform Party now leads in polls of voting intention, led by ally of Donald Trump and Brexit campaigner Nigel Farage. The calculation in London is that as long as Donald Trump is happy, the UK's interests will be considered by the world's biggest economy, and the country can continue to benefit from what has for decades been dubbed the special relationship. But as the speeches at the Unite the Kingdom rally showed so clearly, that special relationship is already in the process of being reimagined. Stuart Smith, DW, London.
Full disclosure, the state visit had not quite ended when we went to studio, so for the absolute final word, check out DW's news pages. Now, what's on Prime Minister Keir Starmer's agenda once Trump has gone? Well, according to the British press, recognising Palestine. Should that happen, Britain would join other nations, including France, Australia and Canada, who have all said that they plan to take the same step ahead of this month's UN General Assembly in New York. Meanwhile, the EU executive has called for a suspension of free trade with Israel in response to the mass-scale killing of civilians in the Gaza Strip, which, according to a UN report published this week, is consistent with four of the five genocidal acts defined by the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. With European public opinion appearing to have reached a critical turning point in relation to Israel and Gaza, we've decided to zoom in on two countries where the issue is currently at the forefront of political debate. First up, Spain. Here's our Madrid correspondent, Ashish Sharma.
As the final stage of the Vuelta de España heads to its conclusion in Plaza Cibeles in central Madrid, thousands of people gather to protest against the Israeli team taking part. In the end, the final stage of the race had to be cancelled when activists waving Palestinian flags invaded the race course near to the finish line. Instead of condemning the interruption of the prestigious sporting event, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez praised those who demonstrated peacefully, saying that Spain shines as an example with pride on the Gaza issue. Following the race, Sanchez called for Israel to be banned from all international sporting events.
I think sports organizations need to ask themselves whether it's ethical for Israel to continue to participate in international competitions. Why was Russia expelled after the invasion of Ukraine and Israel not expelled after the invasion of Gaza?
Spain's solidarity with Palestine, compared to other European countries, reflects its close relationship, both historically but also geographically, to the Arab world. Spain officially recognised Palestine in 2024, becoming one of the first major Western European countries to do so. Its left-leaning coalition has been largely united in its condemnation of Israel's mass-scale killing of civilians in Gaza, reflecting the mood of the Spanish population. A recent poll showed 82% believe that Israel is committing an act of genocide in Gaza. And as I walked up and down amongst the crowds at the Vuelta de España, almost everyone I spoke to was quick to voice their support for Palestinians.
We cannot keep ignoring what is happening in Gaza. And we as Spaniards and as Europeans are being complicit of what is happening. We have the power to break the economic trades that we have with Israel, and we are not doing it. We're keeping them because of our own benefits.
You're young people. Are a lot of young people involved in this kind of protest generally?
Well, what is happening in Palestine, no matter the age, the important thing is to stay here, fight, and show the people that it's a question of morality.
I'm so proud to be Spanish because my government speak every day about this genocide.
And the Spanish government has been backing up its speech with actions. Last week, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez declared that his government was taking stronger measures against Israel. These new measures include an arms embargo, banning ships carrying fuel for the Israeli military from entering Spanish ports, and an entry ban on individuals directly participating in what Sanchez calls a genocide in Gaza. But Sanchez has met fierce resistance from opposition leaders. His main detractors claim that his comments not only isolate Spain in the long term, but also deflect from the domestic problems his government is facing, including allegations of corruption aimed at his wife.
My name is Javier Zarzalejos, member of the European Parliament for the Partido Popular. Pedro Sánchez is a prime minister in desperate need to be seen as leading anything. The situation of his government is so precarious. There are continuous parliamentary defeats. He is surrounded by very serious cases of corruption. So I think that this has seen as a lifeline for him. We have no leverage on Israel at all, no communication with the American administration. Spain has lost any possibility to play a significant role in the post-conflict.
Meanwhile, new cultural battle lines have been drawn. On Tuesday, Spain's national public broadcaster, RTVE, announced that it would be boycotting next year's Eurovision Song Contest if Israel were allowed to participate. Israel has defended its military actions in Gaza and accused Spain of standing with Hamas. But RTVE's president, José Pablo López, said that while Israel has regularly participated in the competition, the current events and the genocide currently taking place make it impossible for us to look the other way. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
To the Netherlands next, traditionally one of Israel's closest European allies and a significant trade partner. But as public opinion has shifted in the face of what most international human rights organisations and a UN independent commission have found to be genocide in the Gaza Strip, parliamentary parties are slowly following suit. Earlier this summer, the Netherlands barred two hardline Israeli ministers from entering the country. A few weeks ago, disunity within the government over whether to take further unilateral steps caused the then foreign minister to resign. Now, one of those steps is being taken anyway. From the Netherlands, Fernand van Tetz reports.
Gaza, Gaza, don't you cry!
Gaza, Gaza, don't you cry!
We will never let you die!
We will never let you die!
It's a windy, wet evening here in Amsterdam, but that hasn't stopped a group of people from gathering outside Central Station in protest. Waving Palestinian flags and chanting through a megaphone, they accuse their government of supporting what they call Israel's genocide in Gaza. Tonight, it's a small group, but protests like this and much larger ones have been taking place almost every week. Protesters believe their pressure is starting to have an impact. Kian is a 21-year-old student who started demonstrating for Palestine 2 years ago.
What we see is the demonstrations are slowly getting bigger. We, of course, had the huge red line protests. Every week we see very large marches, sit-ins at stations. It's really growing into something that puts pressure on the government, and we are noticing that the government is afraid of it.
We see also that the government is really bang for it.
4 weeks ago, the Dutch cabinet rejected a call for unilateral sanctions. That decision led to the resignation of then-Foreign Minister Cosper Veldkamp, who'd pushed for tougher measures against Israel. His centre-right party, New Social Contract, then also quit, further weakening what was already a caretaker government, limping on until a new one is formed following national elections on October 29th. Last week, in a move indicative of the speed at which public opinion is resetting the political dial in the Netherlands, the new Dutch Foreign Minister David van Weel announced the government will look for a way to ban imports from West Bank settlements.
We have gradually increased the pressure as part of the EU, but also nationally. Also, because the humanitarian deal between the EU and Israel is not being honoured, that must have consequences. We have the trade political measure against the import of products from settlements. I can tell you, I have set that in motion.
It's one of the very measures that, just a few weeks ago, New Social Contract were unable to get their coalition partners to commit to. The move is, however, not without its critics. Here is Christoffer, the leader of the Calvinist Reformed Political Party.
It's the wrong choice to continuously criticize Israel, but leave Hamas alone. And it's a completely wrong choice to impose a ban on importing goods from Judea and Samaria.
By using the biblical term Judea and Samaria for the West Bank, Stoffer echoes the language of the Israeli government, which uses it to justify settlements considered illegal under international law. The Netherlands has traditionally been a staunch ally of Israel. 75% of the country's Jewish population was murdered during the Holocaust. That history still shapes Dutch politics today, explains Peter Malcontent, a history lecturer at the University of Utrecht.
The Netherlands was the Western European country from which most Jews were being transported to the concentration camps in the East. We have started to use the Holocaust and the cause of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism, as more or less the basis of our post-war moral compass. And as a result of that, some political parties are using anti-Semitism to accuse other parties who argue we have to do something about the conflict.
Nevertheless, a recent poll showed that 60% of the population want the government to impose harsher policies towards Israel. In May and June, countrywide demonstrations calling on the government to enforce a red line against Israel drew more than 100,000 people. Organisers said these were the largest protests the Netherlands has seen in two decades. Another mass red line protest is being planned for October 5th. Fernand van Tetz, DW, Amsterdam.
Shame on you! Johansson, too!
For additional context to those reports, we will be linking to the latest UN report on the situation in Gaza in our show notes. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, as promised, our Swedish spy church story. Or is it? Local politicians have voted to ask the national government to close down a Russian Orthodox church they believe is being used by the Kremlin as a spy hub. Supporters of the church say the parish and its followers are being treated unfairly due to Russia phobia. Our security correspondent, Terry Schultz, travelled to Västerås to hear their stories.
Even before the Church of the Holy Mother of God of Kazan was built about 150 kilometers northwest of Stockholm, there were suspicions the foundation was being laid for the parish to participate in some unorthodox activities. To start with, its construction, which began in 2019, was funded largely by Russia's state nuclear agency. Then it belongs to the Moscow Patriarchate of the Russian Orthodox Church, which has actively supported the war on Ukraine. Plus, the priest had been convicted of financial fraud years earlier. For hybrid war researcher Patrick Oksanen, who was a journalist back then, there was no question this was not your normal neighborhood place of worship.
It is definitely a tool for Russian foreign influence. And it's a tool that could be used in soft ways, in soft power ways, but also into intelligence or even sabotage.
What made Oksanen so concerned was not only the background of the church, but its location, just 300 meters from a key airport and near the headquarters of some major companies.
It's a long runway, could be very useful for NATO support missions, and it's been used also for Swedish Air Force to do military practices. The second thing with the church is that it's situated in a way with a tower that is high. That could be used, theoretically, to put electronics to do either disturbances or picking up signals.
When Oksanen and a colleague started publishing their stories about this, one city councillor in particular took notice. Elizabeth Unell tried unsuccessfully to prevent the church's construction, but back then she couldn't convince her fellow council members the church could be a danger.
We were naive. Everybody was naive. We couldn't think that this would be a question. But then we get more and more and more information after that.
The government agency that allocates funds to help support religions cut off the Västerås church last year after a stark warning from Swedish intelligence that said Moscow is using this parish, quote, to conduct intelligence gathering and other security-threatening activities. Fredrik Brusi is a representative of that ecumenical agency.
Our decisions do not infringe upon your right to actually practice religion, so that you can still do freely in Sweden. But if the state is supposed to give you grants, then of course you have to be aligned with the Swedish state's values.
Finally, this past summer, the Västerås City Council decided the church's location was too risky. They backed Elizabeth Unell's proposal to ask it to move to another location.
It's not the problem to have a Russian Orthodox church in the right place, but it shouldn't be 300 meters from our airport. That's the big problem.
Russian Ambassador to Sweden, Sergei Believ, says the city council decision is unfair to the church's followers.
It was not their choice where to build the church. It was given to them. Actually, Orthodox people from different places of Sweden come to this church. It's the only church of Russian Orthodox Church working in Sweden.
I wanted to ask some of those people what they thought.
We came here for Sunday morning services, hoping someone from church leadership would agree to come out and speak with us after several requests over multiple days, but they didn't. Most of the worshippers arriving here also would barely look at us. One man shook his finger in a clear sign to go away. A Russian-speaking woman called us spion, or spies. Only one young man agreed to speak with us.
We are obscuring his identity because he's under 18. He said he's proud to attend and defend the church and hopes the expropriation effort fails.
If they turn this church down, they are turning their back against the people who live in their city.
But it seems this conversation may have made the church turn its back on him. After speaking to DW, he tried to attend the services, but they would not let him pass through the gate. Others were allowed in. Elizabeth Unell says the treatment of this young man just adds to her concerns about this parish. The city's formal request to move it will be submitted this fall, and she hopes for a quick decision from the government. Terry Schultz, DW, Västerås, Sweden.
Just a quick reminder of our feedback address here, insideeurope@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Thank you. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. We have a smorgasbord of stories coming up for you this half hour, ranging from the serious to the sublime. To the serious first. Europe is stepping up its support of Ukraine. According to President Volodymyr Zelensky, the first weapons supplied to his country under the Pearl programme, financed by its European allies, will include missiles for Patriot air defence systems and HIMARS rocket launchers. Meanwhile, many European countries are looking to strengthen their own defence capacities, and that includes manpower. With US support uncertain, a recent study says the region will need 300,000 more troops to defend itself. But where are those recruits going to come from? Whilst some countries are reinstating military service, others are looking for volunteers. Lisa Bryant sent us this report from a French boot camp outside of Paris.
Europe needs boots on the ground. These men and women may be among them. The 51 trainees are going through a grueling two-week program. It mixes classroom with hands-on exercises, including live fire practice in a bunker-like building.
Joining the active military is a big sacrifice, and it's not only a career choice, it's a life choice.
Sergeant Marius is one of the trainers here at the 24th Infantry Regiment in Versailles, located about 4 kilometers from the famous chateau.
The reserve, the resource army, can be a good compromise between the civil life and the military life.
Ranging in age from 17 to 57, the trainees include students, parents, and professionals.
The training is really, I think, really rigorous, you know. We wake up early, we walk a lot, we learn how to work together, and I think it's really important.
Constance studies law at the Sorbonne University in Paris.
I decided to join the reserve because I think it's really important to protect our country, especially in the very complicated context we go through.
Although she's careful not to say it specifically as a future member of the military, the subtext here is the Russian threat. That's echoed by other trainees here, like 23-year-old engineer Gabrielle.
Let's say that it is a fact that war is now at the border of Europe, and it's a signal for us to wake up and be ready for if things go wrong. I'm gonna do my part so everybody can be a little safer.
Many of the trainers here are also reservists. Sergeant Marius is a student in his civilian life. He joined the reserves after the 2015 Paris terrorist attacks.
I was 15 when the Bataclan happened, and I feel really useless at that time of my life. As soon as I turned 18, I decided to do something. I joined the army because I was going to meet new people from different places. I think it was very far from my life, so it was a good experience to try something different, something hard.
During their two-week initiation, the trainees are up at 6 a.m. They often don't get to bed until midnight. They run or walk up to 10 kilometers a day, learn how to securely communicate by radio, and use their guns.
We are teaching them that a weapon is dangerous, even if it hasn't bullets inside.
Sergeant Matthew is training this group to handle their rifles, first crouching, then lying flat on their bellies.
But they have to carry them safely, to not point anybody inside alongside them. So they have to be really safe.
France ended compulsory service more than 2 decades ago. But in recent months, thousands of French have applied to join the reserves. The number of operational reservists has more than doubled over the past decade to more than 46,000. And an uptick is also seen elsewhere in Europe. The French government aims to have 105,000 operational reservists by 2035, or roughly 1 for every 2 active servicemen.
Et sans doute jamais, depuis 1945,
Never since 1945 has our freedom been so threatened, French President Emmanuel Macron said earlier this year. We need to accelerate efforts for our reserve and to give youth a new framework to serve. Polls show most French support Macron's goal. One survey found a majority of young French would be willing to join the army if there was war.
I think that people understand that they may have to protect what they cherish.
Retired Vice Admiral Patrick Chevalereau is an analyst for the Royal United Services Institute, a London-based defense and security think tank.
This increase of the military reserve can be a way to reinforce the link between the young generation and the military.
After their basic training in Versailles, this group will spend months more perfecting their skills. When they're considered ready, many will likely join France's countrywide Opération Sentinelle, patrolling streets and securing key sites. Most reservists generally spend about 2 months a year on duty, although that can last longer, with schedules mutually agreed on with their regiments. Those with special skills might be sent overseas. Bertrand, one of the trainees, has signed up for 5 years with the reserves after he graduates from this boot camp. As a municipal employee outside Paris, he says, he's already serving his nation as a civilian. Now he'll be serving it as a combatant. Lisa Bryant, DW, Versailles, France.
Time for the sublime. This week, courtesy of the great Czech composer Antonín Dvořák. The house where he was born in 1841 has just reopened after years of renovation. The end result is an interactive, immersive audio journey through the composer's early life, letting you hear the sounds that he heard, the hustle and bustle of the village inn, the trains rushing by outside, the peal of the church bells, in short, everything that made him the composer that he was. Rob Cameron was given a tour and sent us this report.
Dvořák's Symphony No. 9 in E minor from the New World, one of the most celebrated works in the history of orchestral music, composed in 1893 in New York. The New World Symphony draws inspiration from Native American melodies and African American spirituals, but there's a heavy dose of Dvořák's own Czech folk roots in there as well. The sounds of his childhood in the little village of Nela Hozovez on the river Vltava, just north of Prague. The village is still a bucolic, picturesque place, dominated by a striking Renaissance castle built in the 16th century by the Lobkowitz family. And it's the modern-day Lobkowitzes who own and run the little collection of buildings where Dvořák spent the first years of his life.
Which is the introduction room, and there's just a simple...
Musicologist Eleanor Kinski, a member of another ancient Bohemian noble family, is the curator of the Antonín Dvořák birth house. She began our tour at the wonderful diorama, a bird's-eye view of the village of Nela Hozovez.
The view is as if we were standing a bit above the birthhouse. So there's a model, and all around the model there are different triggers that are related to different buildings in the village. And we did something that was a lot of fun with an ethnomusicologist who found period and area appropriate folk songs, and we re-recorded them, and they are all according to different professions. So for instance, if you tap the village tavern, you will hear a funny song about an innkeeper. It's not a very flattering one, but it's definitely a song that would have been very popular in Dvořák's childhood.
Dvořák spent just 12 years in Nela Hozovez, and only the first six in this building, the village inn that his father ran. But Eleanor Kinski says the little Bohemian village had a deep effect on him.
Later, he passed by Nela Hozovez very often because there's a railway going through the village. And any time that Dvořák would go to visit his publisher, Simrock, in Berlin, or even travel to the UK, and even to the US, he would actually pass by train through Nalahozovets.
My father loved the zither. Sometimes.
This was the sitting room of the tavern. So this is where people would meet up, drink beer, play cards, discuss the latest town gossip. And this is basically also the theme of this room. Since Antonin was the eldest son, he had for sure to help out in his parents' business. And he must have seen a lot of drunk elderly men and observed the music offer that happened. We know that František Dvořák, so Antonin's father, was a very gifted zither player and that he played often for his guests.
And there is a zither here on the table.
There is a zither that we had made especially for the exhibition, so you can actually try and play on the zither. So it's everything in the exhibition can be touched, and you are even encouraged to do so. But we also know that little Antonin sometimes played together with his father some of the popular folk songs. So this room was a family room, so it was one of the only rooms the family actually could use just by themselves that didn't serve to any tavern purposes. And this is why we think or we believe that that Anna Dvořáková gave birth to her son in this very room.
The soothing rhythm of the rocking cradle. I watched my mother rock my brothers and sisters.
This exquisite, immersive exhibition was created by Ralph Applebaum Associates, one of the world's premier museum and exhibition design firms. At the launch, I caught up with Tim Ventimiglia, who runs the Berlin studio that designed the Dvořák House, and his colleague, Anne-Meike Evert, who worked on the content.
Well, this was a really remarkable assignment because we are standing on the authentic birthplace of Antonin Dvořák, and the authenticity of place was our greatest asset. Conjuring that atmosphere of his early life was really our task, and how to do that through different design disciplines without a lot of objects. How do we connect this place to his creative compositions, and how do we bring his voice to life? That was our task.
I think it was one of the most creative processes we ever had, because the museum is about creativity and how you foster that and how the environment can foster that and get you to experience things that lead to musical expressions.
Dvořák died in Prague in 1904 at the age of 62, but he left behind a huge body of work: symphonic poems, choral pieces, concertos, operas, and chamber works. Eleanor Kinski says it's hard to overstate his contribution to Czech cultural heritage.
He's probably the most cosmopolitan of all the Czech composers, even crossing the big ocean and going to the US. And nowadays, I would say, he is one of the few composers that brings Czech culture and Czech music abroad, which is something he did while living and still today.
But in life and in work, he never forgot the little village of his childhood, the sound of his father playing the zither, the bells of the Church of St. Andrew, the ferry crossing the Vltava River. And you can hear all of that here in this modest collection of houses, a short trip along the river from Prague. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Nalahozovac.
Loath as I am to ruin the mood, I have to ask, is Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan turning the lights out on democracy? Because the Turkish opposition party, CHP, says that he is. 16 of their mayors are now in jail, and a court case looms which will determine whether its leadership should be removed and replaced by court-appointed trustees. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Genel Başkanımız, Özgür Özel'i davet ediyorum.
Türkiye İttifakı'nın mimarı.
In Ankara on Saturday, over 100,000 turned out in support of the Republican People's Party, the CHP.
Demokrasiye, cumhuriyete sahip çıkmak için başkente koşanlara.
Özgür Özel, the CHP leader, bellowed that his party is fighting for the very future of Turkish democracy. Özel's voice, as always, sounds a little hoarse. Ever since the march arrest of Istanbul's mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu, which started a legal assault on the CHP, Özel has been crisscrossing the country addressing huge rallies twice a week. Those attending the Ankara rally are heeding Özel's message. This woman, who didn't want to give her name out of fear of retaliation, says, "I'm here for my children's future. I'm here for my grandchild's future. And of course, I'm here for my future. And I support the CHP party to the end." While this retiree also didn't want to give his name, said it's about justice. He said the reasons for us being here are that sadly there is no justice, law or value for humans in general. Everyone is selling our motherland parcel by parcel. The added urgency of the Ankara rally is now the prosecutors are targeting Özel, alleging voter irregularities at a congress 2 years ago. If found guilty, the court can remove the CHP leader and the rest of his party leadership, appointing trustees in their place. Political analyst Atilla Yeşilada of Global Source Partners warns that with CHP challengers enjoying double-digit leads in opinion polls, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is determined to quash them.
I called it CHP versus Goliath. They're really fighting against impossible odds. We're seeing things that show me Erdogan really doesn't have any limits anymore. We're talking about a country where the president is the state and the judiciary and the police and the army. At the end, I'm afraid he's going to get what he wants. And CHP, as we know it, as a opposition force, will disappear or paralyze for a long period of time.
On Wednesday, the CHP saw another of its local mayors in Istanbul jailed. That makes 16 mayors and over 300 other CHP officials arrested since the crackdown started. İlham Özgel, the CHP's foreign affairs coordinator, admits they are struggling against the legal onslaught.
Oh yeah, we're under multi-frontal attack from all directions at almost every level, you know, running from one court case to another. 16 of our mayors are in prison right now, and they threaten our mayors. So they approach our mayors. So there are two options. You either join our party or you face jail term. Some of them refuse such an offer, and they accept to be put into jail, and some of them choose to join the government party.
Beykoz Belediye Başkan Vekilimiz Özlem Vural Gürsel.
Earlier this month, Erdogan at a party rally broadcast live on TV welcomed the latest CHP mayor to join his party. Nearly a dozen have broken ranks. Erdogan strongly denies that any duress is involved in the defections and insists the judiciary is independent. Even though, since he came to power more than 20 years ago, not a single mayor of his party has been jailed on graft charges. But analyst Yeşilada warns, Erdogan, while appearing to be omnipotent, could be taking the biggest gamble of his career.
You look at recent polls, the first complaint of the public remains economic conditions, but justice rose to number two. Is not something that only relates to CHP. It also decreases people's confidence in the system and their propensity to invest into the country. These things don't escape notice. That's what I mean when I say Erdogan took a huge political risk with his career. And it's quite possible that at some point Bahçeli will say enough is enough. You are destroying the country and may also end the coalition.
Deniz Bahçeli is the leader of the National Action Party and has been Erdogan's political partner ever since Turkey became a presidential system in 2018. Erdogan needs the support of his deputies in order to push through constitutional reform, necessary if he is to seek re-election. Barclay has voiced concerns over the crackdown on CHP, which has been courting him. But with the court due to make its decision on the future of the CHP next month, Özgür of the CHP says they are preparing for one last stand.
The only thing that we can do, we rely on our people, our electorate, or our democratic forces in the country. And we're not going to leave the general headquarters where I'm sitting right now. And we're not going to give it up. So we're going to continue with our political rallies. And we're going to take the streets probably. So it's not an easy win for the government. We're going to fight everywhere, at every level.
The CHP is vowing to organise further rallies in the run-up to next month's court decision on the party's future. Additional arrests of mayors are also expected as the legal noose tightens around the opposition. With Erdogan warning, no one is above the law. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
A quick reminder of our feedback address here, insideeurope@dw.com. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Let's go out with a splash. We have a story that we've been saving up for you about Wales and speed limits. Yes, speed limits. Speed limits on an area of ocean known as the Whale Highway. I will let Zoe Bass explain the rest.
It is very important to understand that these species are in danger, are in the brink of extinction. The populations are decreasing. All the scientific knowledge is clear about that, and they need to be protected in a very strict way. We need to impose mandatory measures to reduce speed because it's the only effective way to reduce whales to being killed by ships.
That was Carlos Bravo of Ocean Care. He is one of those behind a recent petition to the Spanish government asking them to make speed limits for ships mandatory in the Mediterranean's whale migration corridor. This Whale Highway is an area of ocean roughly 85 kilometres long. It runs between the Spanish mainland and the Balearic Isles in the northwest Mediterranean Sea. And if you're wondering about those unusual underwater sounds you just heard, that was the second largest animal on Earth, the fin whale. Both fin and sperm whales use this corridor to migrate, mate, and feed. This is the sperm whale, loudest animal on Earth. But fear not, no broken mics here today. The Whale Migration Corridor has been designated as a specially protected marine area under both Spanish and international law. Yet this part of the Mediterranean is also one of the busiest shipping zones in the world.
We are proposing a general speed limit of 10 knots for the whole area because 10 knots is the safe speed for whales. If a ship collides with a whale at 10 knots or less, the probability of the whale being killed is very, very low. It's nearly zero.
Regular passenger liners travel around 20 knots per hour. Cargo ships between 12 and 16 knots. Voluntary speed reduction has been largely unsuccessful. A recent survey of shipping companies in the Mediterranean area, carried out by Friends of the Sea, was revealing. Mario Passoni explains.
This is the most frustrating part of this topic, because there was a problem. The problem was that we are requiring them to reduce their speed. And from almost all of them, the answer was no, because if I reduce my speed, I lose money.
Grimaldi Group is one of the largest shipping companies in the world. This family-owned business runs ships on 18 Balearic routes. I asked their head of external relations, Paul Kiprianou, if the Grimaldi Group would consider lowering the speed of its ships to less than 20 knots.
I mean, it's not easy to give a straightforward answer to that, because obviously we need to consider operational issues, and then we need to understand also the distance for how long, because if it's for a few miles, it's one thing. You understand that people, they don't want to be staying on board a vessel too long, because that makes maritime transport less attractive.
Researcher Antonella Arcancelli of Italy's Institute of Environmental Protection has been working with shipping companies like Grimaldi to collect data on the habits and movements of whales and other endangered marine life. The findings of this large EU-funded project involving Italy, Spain, and France highlight key areas of concern in the Mediterranean, the whale migration corridor in the northwest, and further south in the Alboran Sea near the Straits of Gibraltar.
So it's not just a matter of one company deciding to go slower. It's just a balance between all the traffic in the Mediterranean, the port authorities, and all the other companies and so on. But it could be that it's not necessary to slow down for everyone at all the time in all the areas. And we can focus on the main risky areas.
The Spanish government has been slow to protect high-risk areas like the whale migration corridor. I contacted the relevant ministries numerous times for this report, but received no response to my questions.
In 2018, we succeeded in getting the Spanish government to declare it a marine protected area. This meant that the Spanish government was obliged to draw up a management plan for this protected area. The plan should have been completed and approved by the end of 2022, but the Ministry for Ecological Transition is currently drawing it up.
Part of this management plan would include guidelines on speed limits for different types of ships in protected areas.
At the moment, we have succeeded in convincing both the Ministry for Ecological Transition and the Ministry for Sustainable Mobility to create a working group with all the stakeholders involved, including the maritime industry, to discuss these limits.
Once a management plan has been agreed, it can be legally enforced under both Spanish and European law. This would mean mandatory speed limits with penalties for those who ignore them.
For me, the most impressive thing is when you hear them breathing, no? When you are kind of looking for them and they just appear next to the boat, but you're not really looking, and then you just hear them from behind or something, and then they are there, and you're not one bit afraid of them.
Beatrice Tort is completing her PhD on the fin whales that live in the waters of the Garraf coast near Barcelona. And if, like Beatrice and these school children, we want future generations to experience the joy of seeing one of these giants of the sea in their natural habitat, then governments, shipping companies, and citizens will need to work together to ensure that the ocean receives the respect and protection it so richly deserves. This is Zoe Bass for DW in Spain.
Slow down. Save the whales. A much, much better slogan than keep calm and carry on. That's it for today. The programme was produced by Laura Kabelka, Charlie Shield and me, Kate Laycock. Our sound engineer was Gerd Georgi. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.